Kia ora and welcome to Better Off Red, episode 10.
Wah!
That's quite amazing. 10 episodes! Wah! I'm kind of excited about that. No one else is probably. I'm kind of excited about that. Anyway, it feels like a very special 10th episode to me. Yesterday I went and hung out with Mariah McMillan, you know, stupendous, talented poet, magnificent essayist, very talented information architect, which a lot of people might know, powerful activist, yeah, just wonderful woman. Mariah McMillan and I first met in Dunedin a long time ago. It may even be 10 years ago, but that's too frightening to think about. But yeah, so I went to hang out with her yesterday, which is not unusual. We like to hang out. We hang out a lot. She's an extremely close friend. And yeah, we talk. And this time we decided to record our talking and to talk about the Golden Notebook, which, yeah, I think Mariah was nervous. I was extremely nervous before, with this podcast because, I just get quite speechless about this book. I have found it to be one of the most powerful pieces of literature I've ever read. I have found it to be one of the most articulate pieces of literature I've ever read, one of the most affecting pieces of literature I've ever read. It just, and the cleverest as well. Like it's magnificently put together. You know, the mechanics at the base of it are just incredible. But so I'm really grateful that Mariah agreed to talk to me about this. We had a great conversation, and you know, like, she's sort of, I just feel like Mariah's up to it because she's all the things that the book are, you know, she's articulate and she thinks and she's feeling and yeah, she's just marvellous. Anyway, so I hope you enjoy the podcast and yeah, episode 10. Sorry, I'm still quite excited about that. I thought I was only going to do one, but look what happened. Ah, so yeah, and thanks for listening, if you are listening. Yeah, I really appreciate it and I hope you've enjoyed it. And oh, that's what I was going to say. If you're listening to this through iTunes, if you could throw us a like or a comment, that would be quite helpful, apparently, algorithm-wise. But yeah, that'd be awesome. Or maybe even just drop in and leave a comment at the website as well. That'd be quite cool. Anyway, okay, have fun. Thanks heaps. Hello. So, we are in Mariah's spare room. It's a beautiful room. I usually start by saying where I heard about this book. And I first heard about Golden Notebook when Doris Lessing died. There was an incredible interview that I listened to where she talked about the book and the sort of the disappointment of the reception of the book to start off with. And then the way that she talked about it, I really wanted to read it, but I didn't. And then about 6 months later, I was at like a New Zealand festival launch for readers and writers or something like that. And someone came up to me and said, it was really, I won't mention this person because I think I'll probably get it wrong, but they were raving about how good this book was and Doris Lessing on the whole. And they said to me, she's the best novelist of the 20th century. And then they said, there, I've said it. And yeah, I don't know. Like, I am really leaning towards that. And I feel really nervous talking about this book because I love it so much. And yeah, anyway. But where did you first hear about it? Like, you read it a long time ago first, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. So I think, I was trying to think about it because I knew that this is often how you start. And I was trying to think about where it was. And I think it was probably sitting on my parents' bookshelf. My mum had lots of sort of feminist classic books. And this was probably sitting alongside The Second Sex and The Feminine Mystique and a set of those books. But I remember I was reading other books by Doris Lessing as well at the time. So I think that maybe it was when I was living at home in my first year of university, so I think it was probably around that time. And I remember distinctly that I met someone, I was telling someone in my linguistics class that I was reading, and her name was Martha, and I was reading the Martha Quest series by Doris Lessing, and she said, that's who I'm named after, and I thought that was awesome.
Wow, cool.
Yeah.
And then what I think is so great, because, you know, I'm coming to this book incredibly late, but you read it again recently, didn't you?
Yeah, because you were getting really enthusiastic about it and going, oh my goodness, it's such an amazing book. And so I went, oh, I want to read it again. So I went and got it out of the library.
Yeah.
And read it again.
And do you, is there, I mean, this is the $1 million question, I guess. Was it as you remembered it? Was it, you know, what's it like reading it after that time? Do you talk about that?
Yeah, so one of the things that I remembered really vividly was that that there were, you know, I knew there was this, I remembered there was a novel, and I remembered that there was the four notebooks of different colours, which were very fragmented, and they kind of represented different parts of the narrator's character, and well, not the narrator's, but the main character's sort of life. And I'd remembered it very fondly that at the end she gets a golden notebook where she writes, where she becomes integrated. And where she you know, where all the elements of her come together. And I remembered it very as a victory, and that this was a book about victory and a book about bringing together the disparate parts of one's personality, and being very moved by that. And of course, when I went back, I realised that there is a golden notebook at the end, but a man takes it away. And so, yeah, that's quite interesting in terms of what was it that I need. You know, that book was really important to me, and as were a lot of books. But, you know, this book really did resonate with me in a whole lot of different ways. And but it's just interesting that I had maybe missed the point, or one of the points.
But I
maybe as a 19-year-old, I needed that. I needed the golden notebook.
Yeah. And I think like this was in that interview that I talked about, this was one of the things. Yeah, and this is what I think, you know, just reading again some of the things that Lessing herself had to say about this book, was the idea that people immediately took it. I think some of her frustration, and I feel really nervous talking about this, but I think some of her frustration was that she had crafted this incredible structure of a thing, and it's just so clever. And it seems she, in the interview I heard, she was talking about how she sees it as a book about the disillusionment with communism, whereas it was instantly taken as, she keeps using the word sex war, you know, it was taken as a ball busting kind of, you know. And I think that's what's so interesting about the end, because she was challenged in this interview about the end, you know, that's not a very feminist end. And it's kind of like, well, it's interesting that the motor of the book, you know, like the way the book was made was for one purpose, yet the integrity and the honesty of it is just so amazing. The structure is quite incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, and I was really interested to hear more from you about what you think she did with the structure, and I mean, I don't know if I feel well enough versed in the books that were being written at the time to know to what extent this was a challenge to that. But I mean, the fact that there's, you know, so you've got the novel of Free Woman running through it, the story of Anna and, you know, her best friend Molly and what happens to them. And then you've got the four notebooks. And then you've got the, but then you've also got a lot of sort of historical stuff about Anna, don't you? About Anna. But I mean, I'm not even sure that I can tell you everything that's going on in the book in terms of all the bits.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I feel that's why I feel really nervous talking about this book, because I just feel often I had a very felt response to it. Like thinking about it this morning, I felt overwhelmed again in that, like, this book made me cry a lot, but it was often like I was crying for the for the beauty of it as well, if you know what I mean. And like the fact that that thing where, you know, the best thing in a book for me is when I read something and I think, oh, that's how I always felt, but I didn't know, I didn't have words for it, and that sort of thing. So when I started to think about the structure of it, that seemed kind of, I didn't feel like I had the intellectual power to, you know, put it all together. But I do think that there's something about, I especially think about the, towards the end, there's a piece where, for pages and pages, we are stuck in this hideous relationship, this horrifying relationship. And then in the novel part, it takes one paragraph, you know what I mean? Like, in the novel bit, it's kind of like, oh, he was a bit of a bastard, but you know, like, and I just think that's some of the, that stretching and shrinking that happens in it. And that kind of looking, you know, like that intense looking and experiencing is so, it's so warped throughout it, if you know what I mean. I don't know.
And so much of it, I mean, it's really interesting because so much of it is about writing and about, you know, there's so much stuff where she's, you know, she, Anna, the main character of at least part of it, is so tormented by her own craft and her own art that she can't actually, you know, she's not writing. She wrote she wrote a best-selling novel, which, and she's living off the proceeds of that, but she's unable to write anymore. But at the same time, she's filling these notebooks with incredible writing, although it is fragmented into, you know, different aspects of herself in a way. Yeah, I can't remember what I was going to say about that.
But I so love you saying that because, yeah, that that idea of the writing life and the, I don't know, as I got excited about it because what it did seem to be about was fragments, like you say, like, and then, you know, like, I guess you can do that horrible thing where you sort of say, oh, life can't be pulled together either, you know, but there was just this wonderful idea that, you know, like, this was masterful and beautiful, but it needs some kind of connected tissue for it to be seen as a proper book or a proper something.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I'm going to interrupt you now and say, because what she was doing was saying that she was always condemning herself for translating reality into fiction, and why did she need to do that? And then during the book, you see, you know, you actually watch it as she translates the stuff that that's going on into her own life into these sort of fragments of fiction or into these sort of mini novels that appear within the novels, and you see that constant, you know, stretching and expanding, like you say, like you might have one character tray which is expanded into a completely different character in her novel. So and you also have the novelist being, you know, talking about this process, and so you've got, you know, you've got the different bits in the book, but you also have these incredible layers of self-awareness going on. And I find when I've, you know, when I've been reading the book, then I start thinking about myself differently, or thinking about myself more, you know, being more self-referential in a way, and going, oh, I'm watching myself doing things in the same way that Anna watches herself doing things through it, and that the characters in there do or don't. She's also very tormented by the book that she's written and is ashamed of it.
Yeah, because there's all that interesting kind of capitalist stuff, capitalist market stuff that's happening around that as well.
Yeah,
you know,
with the
people that want to make the movie.
Yeah, and lose lots of the, you know, lose lots of the subtlety around the book and its setting. Like, lose lots of the political dimension of it and turn it into a love story.
Yeah,
you know, a forbidden love story.
Yeah, and it just, I mean, that was one of the things. Like, it was actually this book that gave me the idea for this podcast, because I read it quite quickly after 2666, and I was just thinking, am I being narcissistic, or are all books about writing? You know what I mean?
That's right. I remember you saying.
Yeah, like, I just suddenly thought, you know, like, this book just seems to, like, it feels, you see, that's what I was really interested in about the political content, and that was one of the things I wanted to talk to you, which is a conversation that we often have, is, you know, this book comes out of a political life, you know, it doesn't feel like someone woke up one morning and thought, I'm going to write a political book, you know, it just seems to come out of a life lived you know, politically. And I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I don't know. Like, politics and writing, you know, describe. Yeah. I don't know. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, because I was thinking about that stuff as well. And I was also thinking about, which is sort of related, is that I wonder if the reason that I attached myself and identified so much with this book in terms of being a book of importance was because, you know, both those elements, you know, here was a woman who was involved in the Communist Party for a very long time, who was constantly tormented by the fact that she was involved in the Communist Party and said that everybody else in the Communist Party was in exactly the same position where they were going, what are we doing here, you know, and being, you know, often being extremely cynical about the contradictions within the party and what was happening. And to me, I think that the fact that she was overtly political and doing things which, you know, you would have in quotation marks as political, but it was as much about that, it was just as much about the stuff that was going on for her sexually and the stuff that was going on for her as a free woman, as they sort of, I don't know, you know, as they talked about themselves in terms of, you know, there's a huge amounts of analysis about, you know, about her and her friend, who neither of them are married, and they're living as mistresses or lovers of men in an era where that was not conventional. And the fact that those two things, you know, that every element of their lives is political, and none was, you know, it wasn't that there was a political part of your life and the personal part of your life, which I know is very cliched in terms of the politics is personal and the personal is political and stuff. But to add on top of that, this fact that she was a writer and that she was, you know, and that was also part of the bundle. It wasn't the separate thing that kind of existed out there, that she had her home life, her political life and her writing life. But this book made them all show how completely enmeshed they were with one another. And I think that's one of the great beauties of it. You know, she has the same concerns about, you know, and it's, well, it sounds like the Communist Party, you know, she says with the Communist Party, and it was, you know, that everyone was right. Everyone had a half-written novel, and they all wanted to be writers. And she takes on that role where she becomes, there's a communist publishing house, and all these people write saying, here's my manuscript, and they all want to be published. And it's like she thinks that everybody in the party basically has a half-finished novel. And so this, I don't know what that means. What does that mean,
Pat? I have no idea, but I think this is what I really love about, this is what I really love about this book, is that, I don't know, I'm going to say it all wrong, but it feels experiential in that way that it doesn't seem to be coming to a point, you know, like, I mean, there's a point in it, but there's a point for everybody in it, and I just, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I don't even know if I believe that, but I do think, I never thought of that before, and maybe that's where the Golden Notebook is the fact that the integration of that, all those lives, you know, maybe that's what, you know, and it's such a,
so maybe that's why as a 19-year-old I remember, you know, it's why I remember for 20 years that it was that there was a Golden Notebook. And the fact that thing that I think we've talked about it before as well, that even if you're talking about dark things, if you write about them well, there's a liberation and a joy in that. You know, you were saying that some part of it made you cry, but it was sometimes just for the sheer beauty of the writing. You know, and I think that, you know, in the same way that writing about a thwarted golden notebook gives you the idea of a golden notebook. In which you can live all those lives. And, you know, reading it, it's like the character's incredibly unhappy. A huge amount of it is about their unhappiness. And
it is all laid so bare as well. Like, the characters have effect on other people as well. You know, like, there's the attempted suicide of the son. And, you know, like, there are, you know, then no one's drawn as some kind of hero, I don't think. I don't know.
No, because it's like there's moments definitely with the main characters, you know, with Anna, where she's not sympathetic, and, you know, she's very much of her time and has some of the, And even if she's observing some of the conservatism that she inherent conservatism that she has, which is, you kind of feel like she's sort of forgiving herself, and you're not wanting to stand. You know, you do want to stand alongside her. I think she's a very sympathetic character in many ways, but at the same time, it's like, oh, what are you doing?
Yeah,
like, do you really think that stuff about women and about
homosexuals? Yeah, I mean, you know, that really interesting part about the gay flatmate, and you know, like the he's almost more of an enemy because he's sort of double masculine, and you know, like, there's just, I think there are some really interesting political things in there, and this is what I found really I just keep saying interesting, but powerful. It's just that it's a political era that I know very little about, you know, like, and I feel embarrassed that this book had to teach me a little bit about, you know, African history and communism and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But it just seems so, a friend of mine was talking about how horrific that disillusionment with the Communist Party is, you know, and I just think it really is, it just seems to speak and keep speaking. It just, I don't know, that's another cliche as well, but it just seems incredibly relevant, which is kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And as, you know, I was quite engaged, you know, back to me, but, you know, I suppose because I know that you're quite interested in when people first came across books, and I think that, you know, someone who was kind of, I was getting involved in different groups, I was, you know, involved in the peace group and involved in the women's group, and, you know, invariably you kind of come across different sort of factions of people, but you know, I think it probably gave me an incredible awareness of corruption and the ways in which the motivations for good can be so easily sort of twisted into something really horrifically opposite what people are trying to achieve, you know, or on paper are trying to achieve, sort of thing.
Yeah, it's I just want to put a quick plug in for another book that I'm reading at the moment, which is Jenny Erpenbeck's new book, which is called End of Days. And I probably said the title wrong, but there's a section in there about a very similar time to this. She's in Russia, she's in the Soviet Union during Stalin, and it just exactly what you're saying, you know, that difficulty of everybody kind of trying to move in one direction, but yeah, like just that faction kind of thing. One thing, I don't know if you want to talk about it because I know your essays, you're working on your essay at the moment, but we had a great conversation the other day about you're reading some books from the year you were born. And oh gosh, I just loved what you were saying about how, well, I don't know whether it's depressing, but you know, how articulately a lot of things were being, you know, stated at that time.
Yeah,
I don't know. Do you want to talk a bit about that, or do you want to
No, that's fine. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so I've been reading some books from 1970, and, you know, this is interesting because this was published,
62,
yeah. So it was sort of, you know, 8 years before... 8 years before 1970, because I'm very good at maths.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I would agree with that.
That's right. And so, you know, it's interesting. You know, I'm looking at books published in New Zealand, but it's just interesting to know that this was part of the environment. I've got no idea whether or not the authors that I'm looking at had read that. But, you know, it's interesting in that I do wonder, you know, and I think about some of those other books which are on my mum's bookshelf in terms of this just feels so big and complex. And I think about The Women's Room and that, which is also another big complex kind of book, which, you know, dealt with relationships between women in a very, very intimate way with absolutely no doubt that it was political. Doubt that this was, you know, it's, And I wonder if that's why it had such a big impact, that it was, you know, it felt like it had a big impact to me, you know, 20 years later, that the relationships, you know, the intimate relationships between people, whether it's women's friendships or women's relationships with men, or what's going on in terms of the ability for women to have control over their own lives, that it that this was the core of politics, that it wasn't, you know, having a good rundown of you know, that it was just as important as the kind of big political, you know, things which are named political in the outside environment. And, you know, I feel like I'm a talking cliche in terms of personal as political, which is, you know, which, yeah, feels very sloganish and horrible, and one of the things that I'm really interested about. And one of the things that I think I was talking to you about in terms of the 1970 books is that I think there are really amazing in terms of the complexity surrounding choice. So I think that, you know, we're at the moment we're living in an era of, or I think both you and I are exposed a lot to a notion of choice feminism, where the idea being on one level that no matter what choice a woman makes, it's valid and should be supported.
Mm.
What it ends up becoming often is that if women make very conventional choices, which might be about, or choices which might be about subsuming themselves to men, or taking paths which would be completely expected in the 1950s or the 1960s, of that, you know, or doing things which are actually perhaps could, with some not very much analysis, be quite damaging, that those are equally valid choices. And so the slogan of choice feminism, sort of implying that previous feminisms weren't about choice, seems to be very much of the moment. And what, you know, one of the books in particular that I've been thinking about is Marilyn Waring's book, Over the Fence is Out, which I think it was first published in New Zealand in 70, but was published overseas in 69. And what I find absolutely amazing about that book is that it's an incredible documentation of a woman choosing to get together with a man who is horrible to her, who she's got a pretty good idea that he's killed his former partner, who is controlling. And every step of the way, she observes that he's doing that. She knows that he's like that. She has a relationship with him. She gets married to him. She has his children. She comes out to New Zealand with him. They're in England to begin with. And she's actively consented to this. Mm. And the book is all about, I mean, to me, the book just rings of the fact that the choices made by that woman, you can't look at them without looking at the context. And that's one of the things which feels so much to me as missing from some of the choice analysis, you know, the choice feminism discussions that are going on. And so you've got this, you know, I think there's a lot to learn from books like that book, like Over the Fence is Out, because, you know, on one level you would say, oh, yep, she's, you know, it's like her body, her choice. She's choosing to go and have that relationship. She's choosing to, you know, maybe she likes him, you know, maybe she likes it when he insults her, and maybe she likes the fact that he puts her down all the time, and who am, you know, who are you? Are you being patronising to say that she, you know, you're being patronising if you suggest that perhaps her choice isn't altogether an empowered one? Yeah. I don't know how that relates to the Golden Notebook. How do you think that relates to the Golden Notebook? Yeah,
that's a good question.
Not that we have to stay with the Golden Notebook, but yeah. But I mean, complexity.
Yeah, I think that's what, I mean, this is what I keep thinking of. Like, I mean, both our books are sitting here, and they're doorstops of books.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I mean, they're kind of that doorstop in that there's lots of pages, and there's small words on pages. Sorry, I'm sounding like there's pictures, there's no pictures. But, and I think that's what I think is so great about this, is that it is complex. You know what I mean? Like, it is, and it does look it really clearly looks at context as well as, you know, like Marion, the wife, is that the wife's name?
Yeah, the wife of Anna's lover.
Yeah, yeah. Richard. And yeah. Like, there's interesting things being said there as well. And, you know, in like a lesser novelist, like perhaps me, would have, well, you know, I'm far less, I'm not even, you know, it's cruelly, but, you know, Marion would have been like a foil, you know, she would have been the unfree woman, you know.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, like, Marion becomes extremely complex, and it's a lot about context, you know. Mm. And I think all of them, you know, there's this wonderful scene, and I was trying to find it this morning and I can't, where Anna walks home and she's troubled about the flatmate. He's been slightly abusive, you know, she feels threatened in her own home, but a man steps out and doesn't, there's something happens in the subway. Yeah. And just that sort of, you know, like, that's just, like, I mean, you could write an entire book of just that kind of, that event, but, you know, just that fact that it seems to expose the violence possibly that women feel just going on the subway, you know what I mean? And I just think that kind of contextualizing, and, like, when you talk about layering and layering and layering, you know, like, there are often little touches where you remember, it's an awful thing to say, but it sort of puts Anna back in her place, you know what I mean? Like,
that's right.
You know, yeah, I don't know.
No, I think that's a really interesting scene, I reckon. And she, you know, I think that she might have had exactly, you know, she even tells herself, I experience this all the time. What's the problem? But it's that thing that, you know, that she is suddenly somehow more vulnerable. She's, you know, she might have kind of just laughed off a man kind of stepping out and following her or whatever, it's in the subway, and, you know, there's a number of different incidents as she walks home, and she suddenly feels very, very vulnerable to that. And I think you're right that she can that it feels like an accumulation of things that have been happening to her, which means that suddenly this environment in which she sometimes, you know, which she usually just feels quite robust and might just rebuff all the sort of challenges to women's integrity, you know, suddenly become much more pertinent to her somehow, and she feels attacked by it, whereas usually she's just got some sort of guard up or something.
Because that's the thing that I love in this, like, there's another scene that I always think of in this book where they're watching some ants, there's ant eaters, like these tiny little bugs, and that I think this often is a book about noticing, if you know what
right,
I mean. Like,
you
know, like, you're often in a room and action's happening here, and then you'll look and there'll be something. I often think about it's all getting muddled, but the wife, the place they go to, that kind of holiday kind of, it's a motel or a...
Yeah.
And, like, the wife there, and there's often something happening just over there, and it's this keen eye that kind of builds a world. Like, the world just seems so hugely built and observed in a way that it sort of, you can't look at Anna's actions without looking at the world, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's right. And it's also the writerliness of it, isn't it?
Yes,
because it's like, not, you know, it's like Anna is so aware of what's going on, and she's often, you know, she's writing about herself, but she's observing herself, and she's observing herself, and you know, which seems very, I mean, it seems like it's a writer's eye, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I think I totally agree, like, there is you know, like, I don't know, like, and I often get that, you know, like, I don't get it often, but I do. It's kind of a paranoid ordering that I get, which seems like a writing kind of, you know, like trying to build pattern and story, you know, like, I'm like, oh, that happened, then that happened, and oh, what's that person doing over there? And I think you're right. I think that, you know, this book is kind of not ashamed to be in that psychology, you know, and I think that's the very structure of it, you know, like, to say, here's some writing and here's some writing and now I'm here. And I don't know, it's just so, it does seem very writerly. Yeah. You, I was going to try and tie in something about poetry. I don't know how I was going to do that.
Yeah. I was just thinking when you're talking about, what was that phrase you just used? It was fantastic. About,
oh God.
No, I can't remember it.
Yeah. It's gone now.
Disorderly ordering. No.
Paranoid ordering.
That's great. Yeah. Paranoid ordering. And I was thinking, I don't do that so much. I think I'm not narrative driven.
Yeah.
As a poet, and I'm not about making a story.
Yeah.
But that's all I had to say.
Because I think, this is one of the most interesting conversations we've been having lately. Our other conversations are great. But, I mean, one of the conversations that feeds me a lot is the one that starts with me coming to you. I think I came to you like a year ago going, do you know any stories that don't have a story? I think we were trying to work out how much you could take away, how much we could take away and it would still be seen as, a story. And I'm not talking about giving someone three words and making them order it. I don't want them to have any control either. I don't want them to order it either. And I think that's what's interesting about this book is that it seems to walk you through, but then it seems to resist narrative so much. Because I don't think that the thing I want to write is about, saying, oh, here are three distinct things. Mm. You make the story. And there's something about this that it holds you tightly, but it still doesn't add up to a very conventional arc. You know what I mean?
No, but it totally feels like a story to me. I mean, like saying that I'm not narrative, I'm very narrative driven in story and reading.
Yeah, in reading, yeah.
But it feels totally compelling and all one piece. And because they all do, all the bits do refer to each other.
Yeah.
They're referring to each other. Yeah. Perhaps more than conventional books. Some chapters in conventional books might refer to one another. And they're, like you say, I like that idea of shrinking and expanding, that they take one aspect of something that's been in another kind of form in the book and then and delves into it sort of thing.
And it's that echo chamber kind of thing happening as well. It's that weird thing that through the structure of the book, she's able to revisit things, I don't know. I never felt pounded on the head by the book. I never felt like, oh, she's trying to tell me this or, this is the message of the book or anything like that. But there is that weird echo chamber where, it's like, are you sure you understood who this person was? Here's this person, or you did understand, but no, they're not that person. Here's another facet of them.
Yeah, like the whole transformation of Tommy after he tries to kill himself and also with Marion. So Tommy is the son of Anna's best friend and he shoots himself through the head, doesn't he? And he doesn't actually die, but he's blinded for life and he has a personality transformation. Just before this happens, he's the one who comes to Anna and actually reads all her notebooks and says, what are you doing? And he gets really angry at her. What are you doing separating out your bits of your life? Why don't you just have one notebook? And he's really angry at her. And this is, this is a teenage boy talking to his mother's best friend. Mm. And so it's this weird, this odd, weird thing. And Tommy's been very he's been very teenager. He's moping around the house and doesn't want to do anything. And is bright, and then he shoots himself in the head and becomes blind and is transformed into a happy, non-angry, dogmatic brute in a way.
Yeah,
who takes Marion, his stepmother's, under his wing, and pushes this ridiculous communist dogma.
Yeah.
Down her throat. And so she's transformed from this person who's never been interested in politics, supposedly, into this person who is spouting left rhetoric. And it's because you were saying, before you were saying Marion becomes such an interesting person, it's like she becomes a very simple person.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what it means. I'm not sure what it means that someone who was who lived for her husband, who she knew was having affairs with most of his secretaries, and keeps house for him, essentially, and looks after their children, is transformed into this person who worships her stepson, and takes on his dogma, and he kind of reverts after his accident to a political awareness which is way below what because both Anna and Molly, his mum, are very they're kind of much more intelligent than kind of accepting the left rhetoric for what it is, and they've kind of they analyze it and overanalyze it and overanalyze it sort of thing, but he's back at kind of doing sort of 101 communism let's help out the poor proletariat.
Yeah.
Let's help the poor Africans.
Yeah. And there's that weird, I mean, that thing that all that sits in, you know, like what she's given us is all those magnificent bits about Africa and about about communism and about, you know, like the start of the party and the work that was done in Africa to start off with, and, you know, and then she sits him and Marion in that, which is just so,
and he's blind
yeah, and it just so I don't know, like, yet again it's that absolutely masterful move, because like you say, like, often I was reading for that interest, you know, like, what's going to happen to the next, what's going to happen to the next. And I just think that to do that in such a complicated way, I don't know, it just, it blows my mind. And that, and especially the stuff on Tommy, because there is, you know, that there's, I just remember, yeah, that thing about, if you're anti-patriarchy, what do you do with the son? And what happens, you know, like, what, where does that go? And what, you know, like, I just think that, I don't know what I think. I just think that it is quite stunning that the story of Tommy is kind of, you know, completely complicated in it. And Molly, you know, Molly just feels so bad about everything. And, yeah, I don't know. And then there's Anna's daughter as well, which I, when I was reading back over it this morning, I realised that I had forgotten a lot about Anna's daughter.
Like, well, there's just so much to get in your, to keep in your head, because the story is, it's much bigger than the reader, isn't it? And it's much bigger than the writer. It's like, it's just sort of so big, and there's so many elements of it. And like you say, you know, you could take one little sequence in it and turn that into a novel.
Mm. It's really, it's interesting because Jenny Dusky has, yeah, I've got it written down here because I was scared I was going to call her something else. but I was just thinking, Jenny Dusky has done this great, well, she did a fantastic thing after Doris Lessing died, and has continued to sort of write little bits for the, I think it's London Review of Books, just about her life with Doris Lessing, because she went to live with Doris Lessing when she was a teenager because she was in trouble. Mm. And she talks about Lessing's work ethic, and it's, oh my goodness, makes you feel awful. You know, like, she really did. Because that's the thing about a book like this. Like, I just cannot imagine how one, you know, like you say, it being bigger than the writer, I just can't imagine how someone even begins to write something like this.
Mm.
Like, I just, you know, like, I just, the, in,
yeah, I mean, for me, I, it's like, you go over a page. Yeah. How on earth do you go over a page and still, you can't see it all at once?
That is so true. Oh. But can I talk a little bit about narrative? I just want to talk a little bit, because we had another conversation that was really interesting, and I don't know, we never resolved it, but I think
let's resolve it
right now, right here. I'm quite into black and white, quite into making myself look like an idiot. But we were talking a couple of weeks ago, we did a course together, you wrote a prose piece which I thought was a short story, and we had this interesting thing where, I can't remember how you put it, so if I've got you wrong, you've got your chance to say right, but you said something like, I didn't realise how much I had to make clear in prose, and, oh, you know, in a short story, that I can leave ambiguous in poetry. And that's been absolutely, what's the word, haunting me. Like, I'm just like, I was writing something the other day, and I was like, oh my God, I do that thing where, you know, I have to get people in and out of doors, or I have to get people positioned, or I have to get, you know, and I was just thinking with poetry, you're so right. Like, when I used to write poetry, I could just, you know, like, and I'm wondering, have you thought any more about that?
Oh, yeah, I have, because you texted me, because I said, you know, I said something about it in an email or a text, and you said, I really want to talk to you more about it. And it's like, oh, I can't wait. Yeah. Because it wasn't so much about that thing, you know, isn't there something where people say you've got to get someone from one place A to place B in a novel? It wasn't so much about that for me. For me, it was, it was having to state what was, having to state the emotion, you know, what was happening. And I guess I'm quite used to just hint of something being enough and maybe expanding the space of a poem in poetry. But with prose, and I think that, you know, I was thinking about a lot. There was one of the other people in the workshops who wrote a piece which to me was just so clearly about an abusive man, because there was a bit in there where it talked about him doing things to her. And everyone else, you know, practically everyone else in the room seemed quite sympathetic to that man and seemed to think that he was a bit of a nice bloke and, you know.
He'd had a rough time.
And he'd had a rough time because she was leaving him. And it was like he was, you know, and it was just like there was two lines. Like he was saying the things, you know, he liked it that he could do things to her, and then straight away, which was obviously sexual, and then straight away had some reference to a child, and which just totally freaked me out. And it was like, in my piece, I just mentioned something which there were some technical things that I just hadn't done in terms of making it clear who the characters were, but to me I realized that just saying he watched her wasn't enough to convey or, you know, that he followed her. There wasn't enough to convey that the relationship was one in which this man was completely controlling of this woman and watching everything that she did. And to me it was like so blatantly obvious. And I suddenly realized that actually when I think about it, and I think about reading prose or reading fiction, that quite often you can get away with saying the same thing over and over again in many different ways. Whereas in poetry, our group would just, you know, go, you've said it once, you know, it's telling me what I already know, go away.
Yeah.
And do you think that that's really different?
The other thing that I'm going to throw into the mix, because I was thinking about, the other thing, I totally agree, like I completely agree. And I was wondering if, I'm wondering if it's a fashion thing as well. Like, I'm wondering if, like, the people that taught me how to write short stories, like, well, not, they didn't teach me personally, but I learned through reading their work, are people like Amy Hempel, I don't know, though, that kind of Mark Richards, probably, you know, like, they're not very well-known people, but they all come from sort of the Gordon Lish school where it's very plain-spoken and it sort of wants to mimic conversation, you know, where you will say, oh, well, you know, we did that, and, oh, did I tell you that we did that?
Oh,
and,
right.
You know, the vocabulary is,
he's
like,
being mean to me. He's, you know, he was calling me names. He was blah, blah, blah. Right.
Yeah. And, right, like, where the vocabulary kind of gets squashed because you don't, you know, like, God forbid that you would sound writerly. And I just wondered, because when I read some of this again, like, when I was reading Golden Notebook again, I was thinking that some of that poetics, some of the not being afraid just to, you know, touch it lightly with a finger, I think that it's possibly more in some of these than it is sort of in the modern short story. And I was thinking a lot about Gary Lutz, who I just worship at the feet of. I just, oh, fuck. He's just, I fucking love him so much. And I can't get anyone else to like him. But he's marvellous. And his stories make no sense. Like, I mean,
right.
But they just kind of, it's exactly, he's got this one story which is called Uncle. And that's the title. The title's Uncle. And the whole story is really highly sexualized. And you're like, ooh. You know,
just from the title.
And I think, I was wondering if it's a, I was just wondering if that thing is a, if there's a way of bringing the poetics, you know, bringing that subtlety of poetics in.
And but how does that, like, I'm trying to think of examples, because I think you're probably right. But within Doris Lessing, how is it that that is combined with the fact that she will, like, as we've just been discussing, come back to things and come back to things and come back to things? You know, because before you were just saying, I'm not trying to trip you up, but, you know, it's just interesting that you've got, okay, so she got the light touch, but then she's also got the ability to come back to the same point from a different angle, whether or not she's being Anna, observing what she's written and writing about her own kind of review of it. You know, she has that marvellous bit where her book is called Frontiers of War.
Frontiers of War. I think so.
And then she has this bit in it where she is talking about Frontiers of War, and she says, this is how I would review it up to 1953.
That's right. Yeah.
And then, you know, it's a, you know, it shows, you know, it shows the work of a young writer with perhaps some promise sort of thing. And then her post 1953 thing, you know, she's got a much longer review. But the fact that she has, within this novel, Doris Lessing has created this character who has written a novel, who is then reviewing her own her own novel in two different ways, and then writing about the reviews that she's written of her own novel sort of thing. So, yeah, which doesn't seem that light, or is it lots of light touching?
I think what it is, and I don't know, like, I mean, I totally, yeah, I mean, this is all, what do you call it, in flux. Like, I haven't come to a conclusion about this. Heaven forbid that I should talk before I know what I'm talking about. You know, that's me to a T. But I think what it is I think it's the language. I think it's the balls of the language. I just think it's the, oh, sorry, that's very patriarchal. But, you know, like, I think it's the total, it's the chutzpah of the language. You know, like, it just seems to understand. Every time it comes at it, the language is working all cogs, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's just, it's working its ass off, like, every word. And I think that's where the lightness of touch comes, do you know what I mean? And I think also, I just feel like it's that layers and, like, I think that the lightness comes also because a lot of it is very repetitive and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, but I think what's happening is it's getting hidden in all those other layers.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm not convinced of that argument.
No, I think it's,
but I just think there is something about the language in this which just, I don't know, like, I despair when I read it, because I just think, you know, so much in my writing is, you know, the simple sentence and the simple, you know, like, the conversation, but then you read, I don't know, this might be, again, tangential, but I had not read a lot of English writers. Like, I read Doris Lessing during the year that I was only reading women writers.
Yeah.
And it led me, there are a lot of British writers that I've read a lot of Scottish writers, and I mainly read Americans. But I also wondered if there's something quite British about it. Oh, God, what does that even mean? But, yeah, I just don't know. I just think that there is something in the language that just keeps hiding the non-subtlety of returning to those points. I don't know.
It's interesting, though, because I think that, you know, on the looking at the back of the book, I did read the book, though. I'm not just reading the reviews.
We could do this whole thing on just the back of the book.
Isn't there something, here it says that the New Statesman said, the conviction it carries of being a close transcription of actual experience.
Yeah.
Which to me is partly referencing that the conversations between the women are believable.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how that fits in with the theory, but it's a good another thing to throw in there, that, you know, because you're saying that if the trend is now for conversations to really mimic, I mean, for writing to really mimic the conversations, maybe I misunderstood you then, but this book is, you know, and you're saying, this book is different, but then it's like,
It's the same, yeah. No, I think what I was saying about the language is that it's almost like a parody of language, if you know what I mean. Like, it's a parody of conversation. I don't think it's
trying to make it. So it has all the ums and the boring bits.
Yeah, I don't think it's a simulacrum. I just think that it is, it reminds me of Hal Hartley, those kind of movies where, you know, people are sort of, they might say, oh, Mariah, I feel like a cup of tea. You know, like, I just, there's something like that happening there. And I think also that statement just reminds me, you know, we've talked for a long time and haven't mentioned menstruation, but the scene in there about getting her period, it is so minute by minute. Like, time just, you know, every single detail is like, and I think that's a lot of what works in there as well.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as well, because there's an amazing scene where she's just about to, it's actually the day that she decides to leave the Communist Party, which has been a big part of her life for a very, very long time, and she's very torn about it. But she's got her period, and something has triggered her to think that she's probably going to smell bad, and so she keeps going to the bathroom and washing her thighs and scenting herself. And at the same time, you're hearing her saying, no one ever talks about menstruation. And
there she is.
And it's just, and it's amazing, because it's like, because it sounds like it should be really heavy-handed, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds like it's going to be incredibly boring, and it's going to be this treatise on, you know, like, you know, it's like poems about writing poetry are usually just so dreadful.
Yeah.
And but this is a novel about writing a novel about writing and about, you know, and about politics and actually kind of going step by step through the her own very unfeminist, you know, if you horror of bleeding, her observation of her horror of it.
Yeah.
You know. And even in the observing of the observing, you know, she's not right on, you know, she's not a liberated woman. She's not the free woman at all. She's often, you know, there's so many bits in it like that where it's hard, isn't it? It's hard to talk about technique without talking about the content because they are just so perfectly married or liberated or from each other. But there's so many bits where she's... she is not, you know, she'll observe things. Like there's a bit where she says, they still, you know, it's like they're talking about, Anna and Molly are talking about being free women, this idea that they're kind of unconventional and they're being, you know, Molly's an actress and Anna's a writer and they're living this great sort of bohemian alternative life, but they're still defined as being mistresses and they're still defined as being free women, as in not attached to a man. And so one of them observes that they're still totally being defined in the terms of the relationship to men.
Yeah.
And at the same time, she'll say other things which are horribly, horribly anti-woman in a way.
Totally.
So that, you know, that seems very insightful and you'll get this rush of yes, 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 yes. And then you'll get another bit in which it will be, you know, she'll kind of turn that on its head and decide that of course women, you know, women want, of course women absolutely need men, you know, and of course they want it.
Yeah.
And so it's not a simple, yeah.
Because I think it's
complex.
Well, this is where I think it might be a good place to end, because I think this is so... I would just say read the fucking thing. Like, because I just totally. Think... Like, I just think, like you say, like, any book is hard to explain in a, you know what I mean? Like, in broad sweeps. And yeah. I think the complexity of this is just... I mean... Yeah, I think that the only way to grasp the complexity of it is to read it. And I think I think there would be, like, there is nothing better you could do than
sit down and read this book. I can't imagine grasping the complexity of it, even if I read it five times.
And this is the thing about it, eh? Like, when I heard about it in this interview, I was like, oh, that sounds like a book like X. You know, like, I decided exactly what the book would be like. And when I read the first pages, I was just like, I have never read anything like this before. And all it is, I think, is a conversation. Like, I think it starts in dialogue.
I reckon we should read it. I reckon we should read the first page.
Yeah.
I can't remember what book. I had a book when I was a kid where there was a reader who was best friends with someone who wasn't a reader, and she would read books for them until the exciting bit and then pass the book over to them so that they learn to read.
That's a really good idea. Okay, do you want to read it?
Sure. Just nod to me when I should stop.
So I reckon read just to the bottom of the page because that ends at quite an exciting bit.
Oh, we've got different copies.
Oh, well, that'll be great. Read to wherever you want.
Okay. So the first chapter is Free Woman, which is one of the parts of it. And the little byline says, Anna meets her friend Molly in the summer of 1957 after a separation. The two women were alone in the London flat. The point is, said Anna, as her friend came back from the telephone on the landing, the point is that as far as I can see, everything's cracking up. Molly was a woman with much on the telephone. When it rang, she had just inquired, well, what's the gossip? Now she said, that's Richard and he's coming over. It seems today's his only free moment for the next month, or so he insists. Well, I'm not leaving, said Anna. No, you stay just where you are. Molly considered her own appearance. She was wearing trousers and a sweater, both the worse for wear. He'll have to take me as I come, she concluded, and sat down by the window. He wouldn't say what it's about. Another crisis with Marion, I suppose. Didn't he write to you? Asked Anna, cautious. Both he and Marion wrote ever such bonhomous letters. Odd, isn't it? Is that how you say bonhomous?
I don't know.
This odd, isn't it, was a characteristic note of the intimate conversations they designated gossip. But having struck the note, Molly swerved off with, it's no use talking now because he's coming right over, he says. He'll probably go when he sees me here, said Anna cheerfully, but slightly aggressive. Molly glanced at her keenly and said, oh, but why? It had always been understood that Anna and Richard disliked each other, and before Anna had always left when Richard was expected. Now Molly said, Actually, I think he rather likes you in his heart of hearts. The point is, he's committed to liking me on principle. He's such a fool. He's always got to either like or dislike someone. So all the dislike he won't admit he has for me gets pushed off onto you.
Oh my goodness. I just remembered that first line. The point is that as far as I can see, everything's cracking up.
What a way to start.
Oh my God, because she talked about that in the interview. She said that's what the book's about, you know, everything cracking up, Communist Party, everything. Anyway, thank you so much.
That was great. Thanks.
I enjoyed it. I'm going to turn off the machine now. Oh, the machine.
Nice talking to you.
Good to talk to you too.